Hi, I'm Mark.
Hi, I'm Sophie.
And this is You Know What I Like, where we sit down each month and flail about something that we are unhealthily obsessed with. You Know What I Like? Mike Carey. Mike Carey is a writer who has been professionally writing since the early 90s. With credits at most of the major comics publishers, primarily Marvel and the DC imprint Vertigo, if you read comics, then there is a high chance that you've read something that he's written. For most people in the comic world, his name is associated with a six-year run on the book Lucifer, now a TV show on Netflix, and a four-year run on both Hellblazer and X-Men Legacy. However, for the rest of the world, he is known as the writer of the best-selling novel The Girl with All the Gifts, which was originally published in 2014. As previously promised, we do have an interview with Mike Carey himself, and that will come in the second half of the episode. But before that, we should get to Sophie. What is your experience with Mike Carey?
I have read two of his books. Can we assume that we can go into spoilers?
Yes. In the interview, there are full spoilers.
Okay.
So we can do that here as well.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Because I read The Girl with All the Gifts. Maybe 2 or 3 years ago now, because I knew it had been turned into a film, mm-hmm. and I was intrigued, but I didn't really know a lot about it. I thought it might be children with superpowers.
Okay.
What it turned out to be is
your worst nightmare.
It's two of my fears.
Which are?
Well, I have stress dreams about zombies, whereby I am being chased by zombies.
Okay.
And there are zombies in it.
Yep.
And also, there's mold.
Just everywhere is mold.
I really hate mold. Mold freaks me out. If we're going to, I'm just going to take a tangent on why Sophie hates mold. Mold freaks me out because, is it alive? Kind of, but not sentient.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, but also like
spores. Whoa. Kind of not sentient. Mold is very not sentient.
But it's like alive.
So we're trees.
But this is the thing about mold. Step two is you're like, oh, it's not really sentient, but it is alive.
Yes.
Step three is spores. And I'm like, if I breathe in mold spores, something that is technically alive, even though it's not sentient, is now kind of inside me. And you don't get that with trees.
But like, you know that is what food is as well, like vegetables and everything.
Yeah, but I've prepared food. I've consented to ingesting food. Like mushrooms, blue cheese. Blue cheese has mold in it, but I have consented to eat that mold. If you're just like living your life and then it's like, oh, suddenly I'm in a room full of mold. I don't have a say about whether or not that mold is going into my body.
That's true. Okay.
I have so many fears about like mold. You breathe it in and then it like breathes inside of you and then my insides become mold.
So the book's concept just like fully drives that home for you.
Yeah, so like the book, I in many ways enjoyed it whilst also being so on edge the whole time. Because I was like, oh great, let's describe the mold some more and then get chased by some zombies.
Shall we briefly explain what the concept of the books
are?
That
would be great, because everyone who's listening to this who doesn't know is just like,
mold? Why is there so much mold in this book? So the concept of the world of The Girl with All the Gifts and The Boy on the Bridge is that there has been a zombie apocalypse, but rather than it being the same kind of, like, some kind of virus is the most common version of it, in this world it is based on a real life spore.
Yeah, which is what freaks me out. That, like, it's ants, isn't it?
Yeah, like, it's based on ants in real life.
That, like, takes over the ants' bodies and, like, gets them to do what it wants them to do and, like, grows in their brains.
Yes, but it's that, but in this world that has mutated to be able to infect humans.
When the book starts out, you're following this girl who is in, like, this school and you don't really know what's going on. And then it becomes revealed to you that, like, the reason that there's such high security is because they are zombie children, but they're not, like, your commonplace zombie, which are everywhere. They seem to be more intelligent and, like, in control of, like, their thoughts and stuff.
Yeah, like, if I can go into my background. background with Mike Carey.
Yes, sorry.
And I do want to point out that, like, you've read more than you think you have. Do you remember when I gave you the run of X-Men Legacy that I gave you?
Oh, yeah.
He wrote the first big chunk of that.
Oh, cool.
So, like, anything with Rogue pre her going to the school. So, like, the whole arc with Legion, her in space.
I had no idea.
I think I go into this more like in the interview, but that was my first comic, was those comics.
Oh.
So, like, I've, like, been with him for my whole comic reading experience.
Oh, wow. Okay, then.
I did the same kind of thing as you, where I read The Girl with All the Gifts when, like, it's the one thing, I think, where, like, I heard people talking about it, saying it was good, and then I went and read it.
Yeah.
But then I did read the prequel when that came out, The Boy on the Bridge. And then the book that made me want to reach out to do this interview in the first place was his most recent one called Someone Like Me. So I keep calling it Someone Like You, but that's the
like
Adele song. Yeah. Like I called it to him Someone Like You.
Yeah, you're like, I am a true fan.
I know, I swear I actually read it.
It's just that song was a cultural phenomenon.
It tells the story of this woman called Elizabeth. Because like it's like a story that has a lot of spousal abuse in it. And she realizes that when she fights back, that she has this like darker side of her personality. And it like initially seems like the story is going to go in one direction, like in terms of what that would imply. But it then turns around and gives you like an entirely like different, more supernatural story. The reason why I keep reading Mike Carey books is that you read like a synopsis and you might read like the first few chapters and feel like you know where the book is going to go, but then he always seems to turn it around on you and you're like, this is not the book that I thought that it was going to be, and that's kind of great actually.
I think I felt like that with the first book, mm-hmm. Girl with All the Gifts.
Like, so for like a bit of concept for everyone, the prequel, it tells the story of the vehicle that is found that has been abandoned by the characters in the first book. In this prequel book, it begins with the story of the crew of that vehicle. So you know that by the end of the book, like it is going to be abandoned and there is going to be, like everyone is going to be dead. So then like it's like a story of like you see them building up the hope and like all the things that might be going well with the knowledge in your head that this is all going to come crashing down.
Mm.
Did you connect to the characters in the second book?
I felt like when it was all crescendoing, I was invested. And I, because just because the vehicle is abandoned doesn't mean that everyone is necessarily going to die a horrible, painful death, because the vehicle is abandoned. There's not people in it. So One thing I did enjoy was trying to make guesses about, okay, who is going to die a horrible, painful death?
Yeah.
And like, is anyone going to be able to escape? If they are going to be able to escape, like, how exactly is that going to go down, etc. So like, there is something pleasing about having an inevitability and then trying to figure out, but how are we going to get there? Just because it's inevitable doesn't necessarily mean that you're like, there's no point reading this. It is interesting being like, okay, what's gonna go down here?
Like, I find personally for myself that I really like enjoy the slow build of his books, because I enjoy spending the time with these characters. And there are books that do this too much. Like, I don't know, like if you've read Stephen King's, the one about JFK that I can't remember the name of right now, the date.
No,
one.
I haven't.
That is so long. Like, you know when the build up and the slog is kind of the point?
Yes.
And like, I get that in Stephen King's book that like the slog is the point, but whoa, is it a slog.
You're like, just because you intended it to be boring doesn't mean I'm not mad that it was boring.
Yeah, but I feel like Mike Carey doesn't like approach that for me. Like, I feel like I am getting the time to get invested in these people. And by seeing more of the mundanity, that's not a word, is it? But the
mundanity, yeah.
Cool. That. By seeing more of that, I feel like I get to see them more as people rather than just as vehicles for the plot.
Yeah, I also, one thing I did enjoy was the way it gives you insights into things that you take for granted in the first book.
Okay.
So like in the first book, they've got that like gel, which they can put on their body, which dampens their smell so that the zombies who would be able to smell them can't detect that they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a lot more detail about like, okay, but like, how did this come into being?
Mm-hmm.
Details like that, which are just like taken as world building in the first book. It was interesting to get that little extra and be like, okay.
Yeah. Have you got like any other thoughts that you thought when you were reading Boy on the Bridge or Go with All the Gifts?
Yeah, I still don't know how I feel about the ending of Boy on the Bridge.
Okay.
Specifically the, like, the epilogue bit, which is in the future.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to briefly summarise what that is?
Yeah, so at the end of Boy with All the Bridge... Oh, Boy with All the Bridge?
The Boy with All the Bridges!
At the end of The Boy on the Bridge...
Mm-hmm.
When some of the people who are involved in this thing managed to get away, and they found this, they've been collecting samples this whole time, just to see if there's any areas in which something about the geographic place might be, stop the virus from, or like...
The fungus
from,
is like,
being able to produce and stuff. And there's like this one place which they find, which it's just like inhospitable to the zombie people. So they escape to this place, and then the epilogue is like in the future, after the way after the events of the first book have finished, which the first book ends with... I'm just spoiling everything here.
Spoil everything.
But the first book ends with our main character making the decision to essentially purposefully infect everyone with all this fungus, because that's the only way that you'll get this new race, which is the intelligent children, which is like the best of human intelligence with all of the enhanced stuff of these zombie people. And the first book ending like haunts me, because her teacher, who has been like, she's just very attached to and all that stuff, is sort of like trapped now. She has to live in like biohazard suits and teach these children, and like for seemingly eternity.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, like, it's a bit like there is no way that she would not lose her mind.
Yeah, but I loved that. I thought it was such a great final note. Like, it's, you expect them somehow to be able to put a stop to it, and then what actually happens is it's like, oh god, this woman is trapped forever. And then that's why I don't know how I feel about the ending of The Boy on the Bridge, because The Boy on the Bridge ends with Melanie leading all of her little zombie people up to these guys on the mountain and being like, oh, we want to give you back this lady who she's not had anyone for a very long time, and they like give the teacher to the humans, and they're like, we're gonna feed you.
Is part of your problem with The Boy on the Bridge the fact that it takes away from the tragedy and the weight of the first book by giving her and the human race this happy ending?
Yeah, I feel like I would have liked The Boy on the Bridge slightly more if it didn't have the epilogue, because now the first book haunts me less, which you'd think I'd be happy about.
True. Yeah, but like there is like a, not a joy. Some books that are so tragic are so interesting because yeah, they're so tragic that even though the heroes don't get a happy ending, like, you just like think like that was so moving and so affecting and so haunting in this context.
Yeah, so like in many ways there are things about that epilogue which is interesting, because it's like, oh, is this now opening up a time, like, these effectively two different races now, are they gonna have to start cooperating? There are really interesting like implications there.
Mm-hmm.
But also that first book ending like haunted me so deeply that I also feel like that's slightly taken from me, because I now know what happens to Miss Justino, whereas before I had the horror of my endless imagination.
I do like the image now, though, that because that epilogue ends with, like, Miss Justino is the one who's driving the vehicle.
Yeah.
That, like, she is, like, barreling through, like, trees and everything, being like, bring me to humans, I'm going insane. I do fully, like, understand with it subtracting from the tragedy of it. I feel like I got so invested in the people that I really yeah, wanted a happy ending.
That's fair.
That, like, with the crew in The Boy on the Bridge, I was so invested in some of them that I was just like, I really hope that they survive. And, like, you know when like, a piece of fiction, like, jumps forward to, like, a future and you're waiting for, like, a list of the names to be read out, basically. I'm just like, yeah, oh, thank God that person's still alive. Okay, great. That person is still there. Great, fantastic.
Yeah.
Because, like, even though when I first read that epilogue, I did fully cry when Miss Justino appeared. I do see your argument that it would have been really great to have her not be there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult.
I don't want suffering.
Yep.
Normally I'm like, give me the happy endings. I think I just went into such a state of stress reading these books because I'm being confronted with some of my nightmares that I was like, bring on the horror.
Or like, is that how you cope? That you like swerve into the skid because you're just like...
I was just like, this is where we're at now. This is my life. Yeah. Haunted by mold.
Speaking of haunted by mold, this is a good time to transition into the interview, I think. Unless you have any more thoughts, Sophie?
No, transition away.
So when I did the interview, there was a bit of an issue with the audio recording and I couldn't get it to work. I was panicking. So the quality of the audio of this interview is a bit haunted by mold. But please bear that in mind that it is still very, you can hear him, it's just not the highest quality.
Yeah.
Yeah. So so far we've been talking about Mike Carey, but on all of his books that we've discussed, other than X-Men Legacy, he's been credited as M.R. Carey. And I wanted to ask him what exactly was the reason behind this change? Why did he make the transition? So my first question for you is, you've gone by Mike Carey as your credit, and now for your most recent books, you've gone by M.R. Carey. What is the reason behind that distinction? Like, was there a conscious choice behind it?
Yes, there was, very much. And it happened with Girl with All the Gifts. So Girl with All the Gifts was my 10th novel. And all of the previous ones, with two exceptions, had been by Mike Carey. So I handed in Girl with All the Gifts, and my publishers were very happy with it. They felt that it was like a sea change from the stuff I'd done before. They thought that it had a lot of potential crossover appeal. So they said, what we'll do is we'll give you a very, very mild, very transparent pseudonym to make buyers, especially big chain buyers, look at it with a fresh eye rather than looking at it in the light of the books that you've written before. And that worked very well, in fact. So initially they said, well, they're just going to use your initials. What's your middle name? My middle name is James.
Mm-hmm.
So the English proofs, the British proofs of Girl with All the Gifts are by M.J. Carey. But the day that they came out, we discovered there was already an M.J. Carey on Goodreads. She is very prolific and she writes bondage porn. So the title Girl with All the Gifts acquired a different set of connotations when you were looking at it in the context of M.J. Carey's other works, Daniel's Chains, Daniel's Dungeons, Daniel's Secrets. We kind of very quickly put in a different initial, a completely invented initial, hence M.R. Carey.
I see, that makes a lot of sense, okay. When I was doing the research for this episode, I did find something that I feel like you will appreciate, Sophie. One of the first things that Mike Carey wrote was a biography, in quotes, comic of Ozzy Osbourne.
Excellent.
Like, it was published in 1993, and the tagline of the comic, which is Rocket Comics, is the name of the brand. And the tagline is the first and only fully authorized comic magazine series dedicated to rock and roll.
This sounds like something my dad...
I was fully thinking that.
...may have even read.
Probably.
For all I know. He might have been a bit busy because I had just arrived into the world. So
yes.
He might have been like, I don't have time for comics. I have a newborn baby.
That is possible. So what I wanted to know from Mike Carey was whether or not he had actually spoken to Ozzy Osbourne himself.
I didn't speak to Ozzy. I did speak to Ozzy's machine. I think I spoke to Sharon at one point. But certainly I had a lot of contact with his publicist. And they arranged for me to meet up with a super fan.
Mm-hmm.
I met him at Heathrow Airport. And he handed over like a ton of scrapbooks covering Ozzy's entire career, just masses and masses of material, which I had sort of sitting beside me as I wrote. But the way that happened was extremely strange. It was because, and I should confess at the outset, I'm not a heavy metal fan. Mm-hmm. I did the Ozzy book and I did a Pantera book.
Mm-hmm.
And Lorene Haynes very, very kindly offered to rep me. She was trying to set up a comics agency along with her husband, Dave Dorman. They said that they would sort of like show my stuff around to American publishers and try and get me some work. They never took a penny from me for doing this, but they did manage to get me a couple of gigs at Malibu Comics, and Malibu were doing Rocket, which was an imprint entirely devoted to stories about rock legends. So they asked Loreen, does your man, does he know a lot about heavy metal? And Loreen, God bless her, said, yeah, he adores heavy metal. He's a huge fan. He knows everything there is to know about heavy metal. Uh-huh. And so they said, well, he can do the Ozzy Osbourne book then. And I had to sort of become an Aussie expert in a very, very short time. Mm-hmm. It was crazy fun, actually. The Pantera book, less so, but the Aussie book was great fun. It was basically, the brief was just to write a story that, with the flimsiest of excuses, kind of recaps his life with a slight sort of horror fantasy overtone to it. So I just had fun, and the artist who I worked with on that, Tom Cuffin, was an amazing painter in acrylic. Mm-hmm. And just a glorious work. I still have one of the pages from the Aussie book up on my wall.
Oh wow!
So it was a really nice induction into the American comic book market.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's a really good agent though, who's like, yeah, he knows all about heavy metal. Like, I'm knowing that you didn't. Like, that's like a really good agent.
As I say, the Pantera book was a slightly bumpier ride. I was working to a story which had been put together by Phil Anselmo, the lead singer of Pantera, and it was basically just Pantera get kidnapped by vampires and tortured, and then they break free and they kill the vampires, and there's a happy ending. I had to turn that into a story. I'm not sure I entirely succeeded.
I'm sure you did.
Okay, one of the things that Mike Carey is known for in the world of comics is for taking the character of Lucifer and spinning him out into his own book. So Lucifer had been a recurring character in the Sandman comic series by Neil Gaiman, but was now being taken into his own book. People listening might be aware of the currently running TV series starring Tom Ellis as Lucifer, which is the same character. And like, if you love that show, then you have Mike Carey to thank.
I didn't know that was his.
It is.
I'm learning so much today.
Yeah, like he wrote that book for 6 years, I believe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask Mike Carey how that book got put together.
So this is a few years after the Ozzy Osbourne book.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I had done a lot of work for a company called Caliber. And I did a book called Inferno for them with Michael Gaydos. I did a Dr. Faustus kind of adaptation of the Faust myth with Mike Perkins. I got paid, you know, 4/5 of nothing for that. But the books came out, and the books were beautiful. And everything that I got out, I would send to the editors at Vertigo with begging letters saying, please, please, please let me work for you. Uh-huh. Because everything I was reading back then that I loved was from Vertigo. It was kind of like it was where everything was happening. And Sandman in particular was my favorite book. It seemed to me that Sandman had completely changed the game for long-form comic storytelling. It had created a new template. So I was sending them all my work, and not really getting much of a response, but Elisa Quitney, who was the editor on Sandman at the end of its run, wrote to me a couple of times and said, yeah, there's some nice stuff here, you should pitch for this project or that project. And for a couple of years I was pitching and not getting anywhere. And then suddenly, out of the blue, they called me up because they had started the Sandman Presents line. And for whatever reason, they had decided not to proceed with the Lucifer miniseries. They had a writer for it, but they weren't happy with the script. They were happy with the story outline, but for some reason the script weren't working for them. So they paid off the original writer, and they needed somebody to sort of step in very, very late on. So Alita called me up one day and said, do you want to write a Lucifer miniseries? But bear in mind, if you say yes, you're going to have to move on it right now. I think I said something like, don't make me beg. I was just incredibly excited at the prospect. I put together a pitch in 48 hours by not sleeping or eating. Mm-hmm. And got the approval like 3 or 4 days after that. And then I was just straight into script. Neil Gaiman was on board as creative consultant and was really generous with his time and advice. So I got to actually sort of talk to Neil about how to tell stories within the Sandman universe and to sort of bounce my ideas off him as I went along. It was, it's very rare that you reach a turning point in your life and you know right then and there. But this just felt like, my God, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
That ran for 6 years, if I've got that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you have any, like, moments in that run that jump out to you when you look back at it now of, like, memorable things that happened in the writing process or in the general, the reception that it received or anything like that?
There are two moments that stick in my mind. One is very, very early on in the run, we lost our entire art team. So if you look at the first three issues of the monthly book, the miniseries preceded it and was had fully painted art by Scott Hampton. But the first three issues of the monthly were penciled by Chris Weston and inked by James Hodgkins. And they didn't get on. For whatever reason, they just, you know, Chris was not happy with the way James was inking his work. They argued about creative directions. On the third issue, they agreed to go their separate ways. I believe they're good friends now, so yeah, this was not a lasting break. But for us, it was a disaster. We were 3 months in, and we were scuppered. You know, the art team is what gives the book its identity on the shelves, its visual DNA. And we just lost both our penciler and our inker. So I thought, this is it, we're done for. Shelley Bond, who was my editor at the time, said, don't panic. I'm going to approach Peter Gross, because Peter Gross has just finished working on Books of Magic. He would be a perfect fit for this book. So she reached out to Peter and asked him if he wanted to work on Lucifer. Peter's answer was, I've just spent like 6 years working on Books of Magic, working on a fantasy series. You're asking me if I want to start another fantasy series straight away.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, over my dead body. No, that's the last thing in the world I want to do.
Yeah.
So Shelley said, well, can I just send you a script? And she sent him the script for issue 4, Born with the Dead, which in the end he didn't do. Dean Ormston did the art on that issue. But Peter read it and liked it and said, I'll do a few issues. I'll come on board for a little while. And he ended up being the main artist for the entire 75-issue run, and then for 70-plus issues of Unwritten, and for Highest House. Yeah, here we are, something like the best part of two decades later, and we're still working together.
Oh, wow, very
still,
nice.
We're still really good friends. So what seemed to be a disaster actually was the best thing that could possibly have happened. We got Peter, we got Dean, and suddenly we were off to the races. We had an identity, and I couldn't have been happier. The other memory is not such a happy one. When we did Lucifer Nirvana, John J. Muth was doing the art on that. It was the standalone novella that we did during the run. And he was working on, there's a sequence at the end of Nirvana, which originally has the angel Perdita striking the wings off a 747, just hacking the wings off it with a flaming sword while it's in the sky, and sending it crashing down to Earth in flames, and it crashes into the Tiananmen Gate in Beijing. While John was painting that page, 9/11 happened.
Ah, wow.
He called me up and said, my hands are shaking, I'm not going to finish this page, this page is not going to be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, you're absolutely right, it's not. And we had to just completely rework the ending because, you know, there was no way you could do that story, there was no way you could play that beat.
Wow, yeah, that's a powerful moment. Like, how long was it planned for? Once you got past the, like, original miniseries, like, how long was the, like, ongoing planned for it?
We always knew it was going to be finite. We always knew where it was going to end. So when I originally pitched it, I said, this is what we're building towards. We're building towards a climax where there is a second war between heaven and hell, and Lucifer fights on the side of heaven. We didn't know how long it would take to get there. And we didn't know really what route we were going to take. We knew what some of the big landmarks were going to be. But as Neil had told me when I was first pitching the series, he said there are an awful lot of things that just happen because they happen, because you have a great idea as you're writing and you can't leave it out. So we knew where we were going, but we didn't know how we were going to get there. When I got into the habit with Shelley, Shelley liked to see plans in advance. So I would block out each year as I went. And we got to the sixth year and I said, basically, I think issue 69, the end of Morningstar, that's going to be where we sign off. And Shelley read the plan and said, yeah, that's the climax, but that's not the ending. I think you should probably think in terms of wrapping up your key themes, saying goodbye to all your main characters, and sticking around for a little longer. And she said, you know, far from advocating this, but Sandman was 75 issues, you're within spitting distance of 75 issues. there would be a pleasing symmetry. So I went back and thought about the stories that became Evensong, and I was really glad I did, actually, because I think that that last sort of sequence of stories after the sort of big epic close of Morningstar, I did some of my best work there, and I think Peter did too. And one of the wonderful things about Vertigo is they allow series to be finite. You know, if the creative team say, this is where the story ends, they would let the story end. They wouldn't say, okay, we're just going to put a different writer and artist on it. But so yeah, looking back on Lucifer, I think my abiding memory is just one of incredible happiness. It was six years of learning the ropes. It was the first time I'd ever done a monthly comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn it by doing it. You know, there's no other way to learn it. You just find out how to do it as you go. You put your toolbox together as you go. But I was just incredibly lucky with my collaborators. Peter was amazing. Dean was amazing. Shelley, one of the best editors I ever worked with. And then, you know, we had Todd Klein doing lettering. Danny Vozzo doing colors. And we all just loved what we were doing. And we all just really got on well together as a team.
And then at the same time as defining the character of Lucifer, Mike Carey also took over the reins of the established character Hellblazer, who is also known as John Constantine. So Mike Carey says John Constantine. I always said John Constantine. I assume he's correct.
I always said Constantine, but then I would trust him more than me.
Yeah, he wrote the comic.
Yeah, I'm going to bow down to his.
Yeah. Guy. I asked him how different it was to come into a character that had already been so well defined. Find in comparison to Lucifer, who he basically got to build from the ground up?
They were very different. I was about, I think I was just starting my third year on Lucifer, and I got a call from Will Dennis to say that Brian Azzarello was wrapping up his role on Hellblazer, and he asked me if I would like to pitch for Hellblazer. And I said, no, I don't want to do that, because I was already writing a monthly book. Mm-hmm. And it never occurred. I honestly didn't believe at the time that you could write two monthly books. I said, thank you for asking, but no. And Will said, I'm not going to take that first answer. I'm going to put the phone down now. I'm going to wait for you to change your mind.
Wow.
Within a couple of hours, I called him back and said, yeah, you're right. I can't not try. I have to try.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Well, one of the things about John Constantine, I think, is that if you look at all the runs, everybody changes the furniture. Everybody gives John a different set of supporting characters, moves into a new location. But there's always something. They put their own spin on John, but there's something enduring that doesn't change. There's something recognizable as a core that is absolutely distinct, and that's kind of like the very definition, I think, of an icon. So I in my run on Hellblazer, I went back to Warren Ellis's very, very brief run. He was only on it for a year, I think. I just stole all the characters that he'd set up. Uh-huh. And then never got to reuse. So Clarice Sackville, Albert, Watford, Matt, and so on. And sort of polished them up, filed the serial numbers off, and put them in my stories, which was a lot of fun to do.
Like, it sounds like you didn't feel like the past of the character was like a weight that burdened you. Like, you used it as a resource for your story.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you get to pick and choose. You get to sort of like decide which aspect of the continuity you're going to revisit and kind of bring back to life in your run. In some ways, I guess I took him back to what I considered were his roots.
Mm-hmm. In terms of bringing him back to where he grew up, I've seen a lot of conversation about his accent. And what it should be, should in quotes. What's your opinion on John Constantine's accent?
Well, he's lived in London for a sort of a long time. I don't think there'd be much Scouse left, to be mm-hmm. honest. Maybe a little twang. And I would imagine that when he goes back to Liverpool, it comes back.
Yeah, okay.
Because that seems to be what happens to most of us.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, yeah.
But I think that if you met him on the streets of London, he'd be talking something like London English, Estuary English.
Yep, okay.
then after that, Mike Carey took over the reins of the book that I first discovered him in, and that was X-Men Legacy. Creators making the move between DC and Marvel is always surrounded by a conversation of why. So I wanted to ask Mike Carey what his reasoning was.
It's not an obvious jump, is it, when you consider that all of the DC work I did was dark fantasy. Mm-hmm. There's a backstory to that, really, which is that I really loved writing for Vertigo, and I think the books I did for Vertigo are some of the books that I have fondest memories of and that I'm proudest of. I also wanted to do superhero books, and I kept on trying. I kept on nudging the DC Universe editors and asking if I could do something, like a short arc or a miniseries there. And I kept trying out, and it kept on not going anywhere. I did 3 issues of Superman that were spiked and never got published. I did 3 issues of Batman that were spiked and never got published. I was kind of, this was work I was paid for, but it was not seeing the light of day, and it was frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredibly discouraging. And then I was at San Diego 1 year, and I bumped into Axel Alonso, who had been a Vertigo editor before he moved to Marvel. And he said, "Well, look, I know you're on an exclusive at DC at the moment. So I'm not going to insult you by offering you work now. But if you find yourself free a year or 2 years down the line and you still want to do superhero books, seriously, give us a call, because we can offer you something." So that's what I did. I waited out my exclusive. I didn't re-up. I called Axel, and Axel said, "Stay by the phone. We'll put together an offer for you." And the next call I got was from Mike Martz saying, "How would you like to write X-Men?" And I honestly thought it was a wind-up, because I didn't think they would offer me something that huge just mm-hmm. out of the gate. I grew up with those characters. I loved both the Fantastic Four and the X-Men. It's kind of like adding rooms to a house that you lived in when you were a kid. There's something really special about it.
Yeah.
So I put together a pitch, and they gave me the green light, and I took over with issue 188 of Adjectiveless X-Men, and stayed with it till it became Legacy, and then I wrote it for three years after that. It was just a wonderful time, because the brief was basically Ed Brubaker had taken over on Uncanny and had chosen his team for Uncanny, and I said, "Well, who do I get then?" And it was basically everybody else. I could take my pick of all of the other characters. Inevitably, I couldn't decide, so what I did was I put together a team that just kind of like rotated all the time. After that first year, I kept on like assembling different teams around Rogue. For each arc, with a special emphasis on characters that nobody else was using at the time. I just loved being able to pick up cool characters that had been sort of lying neglected in a drawer for years. Characters like Ariel and Omega Sentinel, Frenzy. A big part of the pleasure was just like putting together these crazy and unworkable teams and just seeing how the chemistry worked.
Your run on like X-Men Legacy, like that was actually the very, very first comics that I ever read.
Really? God.
Yeah. So like I jumped in the arc where Rogue goes to space to save Havok and Polaris and Rachel Gray, and there's Friendless involved there as well.
5 miles south of the universe.
Yes, and it was just, like, it was a lot to jump into, like, in the middle of, like, I'm just going to read comics now, and I pick this one. And then I was like, so, Rogue I know from the films, but then there's, like, all these characters that I have no idea who they are.
Yeah, it's a very convoluted continuity. If you pick up two X-Men characters at random, the chances are one of them's killed the other at some point, they've been married, or they've had a relationship.
I just remember spending the first few comics of that run that I read just on Marvel Wikipedia being like, "Who's Lorna? She's an android? What? I'm sorry." Okay. Like, you touched there on the convolution of the X-Men comics as they've run for like 50 years at this point. And like, you got to add to that to some degree with the stories that you got to tell. Do you ever find that people come to you not just about X-Men and talk about the comics that you've written and about like specific plot points that you introduced that like you don't have like any memory of introducing?
Yes. Yell all the time. Because I think an awful lot of what you do these days is you become kind of like the instant expert. You know, you gen up on a series and make yourself the master of the backstory, mm-hmm. of the continuity. But you can only hold that in your head while you're fervently working on it. And then as soon as you let it go, well, the first thing that happens as soon as you let it go is people keep adding it on and adding on to it. So a good example of that is Vampirella. I gave Vampirella an origin story that kind of harmonized the two origins she already had. But then almost as soon as I'd finished writing it, somebody gave her a different origin again. These things don't stand still. It's kind of like trying to jump on board a moving train. There were some things that I did that were controversial. I think probably the most controversial was, I was going to say instituting, but like revisiting the idea of a romance between Rogue and Magneto. That there had already been a story where that had happened. It briefly happened. They'd fallen apart under the strain of their differences. There were as many people who hated that as loved it.
Okay.
I got serious hate mail for. Because there are a lot of Rogue Gambit shippers.
Oh yeah.
All the way back then, and they were not kidding. You know, they were serious about it. There was a woman I met at a signing who was delighted when I made Rogue the leader of a team and gave me a lovely piece of art that she'd done herself, a pin-up of Rogue. But she never forgave me for the Rogue Magneto stuff.
Wow. Did you choose to do that because you read that like original scene and you thought that they made a good couple, or because you thought that it would make a good story?
They would make a good story, and I thought it made sense for both of them,
okay.
as characters. I thought they would be, you know, they would be mutually attracted. It would never be smooth, but it would be interesting. One of the things that Mike Marth told me when I first started writing on the book, up to that point, I'd only done Vertigo books, and the Vertigo message boards were incredibly well-mannered. As soon as I was announced on X-Men, and as soon as my team was announced, there was already a shouting match about things like Sabretooth and Mystique being on the team. There were already people who were deciding, you know, this was beyond the pale before they'd read a page. And I panicked. I thought, I wasn't really ready for this sort of degree of strong feeling. And Mike Marth said, you've just got to let it wash over you. He said, everything you write on a book like X-Men is going to be simultaneously somebody's dream come true and somebody else's worst nightmare.
Do you get used to it, or do you stop looking at it?
I guess both. You get used to it, and one of the things you do as a defensive reflex is to look away when things get really heated. There's nothing really you can really do that's constructive in a situation like that. Your story is your ambassador. There's nothing you can say in addition to the story, really.
After a long run on a wide array of comic characters and teams over a couple of decades, the next piece of work that I discussed with him was Girl with All the Gifts. We've already covered the main concept of this book, but what you need to know is the name of the kind teacher, who is Helen Justineau, and the morally ambiguous scientist, Caroline Caldwell. The first question that I asked was how the book and the screenplay were both developed at the same time, and how that worked.
I'd already met Camille Gatin, who was the lead producer. Mm-hmm. On the film, and we were working on a project that was a science fiction movie based on a YA novel, and then we lost the rights were sold away from us. I'd already met Colin McCarthy, the director, at that point, and the three of us looked at each other, and Cammy said, well, what else could we do? And I said, well, I've got this short story that I've just written and it hasn't even appeared yet. That it was Iphigenia and Alice, which became Girl with All the Gifts. Colin and Cammy both read it. Colin said, you know, I've always wanted to do a post-apocalyptic movie, a ruin porn movie, a movie that would use like decayed urban landscapes. Mm-hmm. And so we started working it up together, and it was an incredible experience because the three of us, actually there were four of us, there was another producer who was initially involved. We would just sit in a room, usually sort of quite late at night, and usually it was somebody in a room in somebody else's building where one or other of them was doing editing or post-production at the time. We'd just like arrive at 6 in the evening and stay till 1 or 2 in the morning and just brainstorm ideas. And until we had a story that we all felt really, really happy with. And at the same time, I was writing the novel. And I think the the novel and the movie, they don't quite work in parallel with each other, but I think each of them is sort of like recognizably a fraternal twin of the other. Mm-hmm. I think they do the same thing, but in different ways.
Yeah. Were there like any scenes that like informed like each other where like you thought like, I need to have this scene in the film, so like I'll put it in the book? Like, did they like impact each other at all?
They did impact each other. I think each process kind of clarified the other. So weirdly, doing them side by side made each of them easier. You would think that maybe there would be some confusion, but actually there wasn't. It was it made it easier to think through the different lines through that story space, because I was living in it all the time. What happened was that the movie went on, the production process for the movie, sorry, the development process for the movie went on much, much longer. So the novel was out in January 2014, and we didn't start filming until the middle of 2015. So there were 18 months when the novel was already in the world and we were still working on the movie, which meant I was still sort of like, I got to have second thoughts about certain things. And I think there are some later scenes in the film, especially the final confrontation between Melanie and Caroline Caldwell, which maybe work better in the film because I'd had longer to sort of think about where Caldwell was coming from and how that might be a tragically defining moment for her. So in the novel, she basically dies at that point and therefore leaves the story. In the movie, there's a conversation in which Melanie forces Caldwell to admit that she is human. I think it's a better way for that relationship to end, and therefore that she has just spent the last 10 years of her life dissecting children. You know, that actually she's not the hero of this story, she's a monster. And that is, yeah, that's her tragic fall.
But then after the success of Girl with All the Gifts, Mike Carey wrote a prequel to it titled The Boy on the Bridge, as we've already covered. With only a tragic end awaiting these characters, there are similar conversations to be had about both books surrounding the morals of human survival. In both The Girl with All the Gifts and The Boy on the Bridge, like, both of them very, very heavily deal with the theme of what is the cost of survival and of, like, achieving the victory over the fungus. Is there a reason why you, like, explored that? Like, what draws you to that theme?
Well, I think there's a lot of possible answers to that question. There's a reason why apocalypses are so much in vogue at the moment. I think people explore the end of the world when the end of the world feels imminent. It's a way of asking questions about who we are and who we might become. If you live through an apocalypse, if you live through the ending, the fall of a society, the fall of a way of life, then basically all of the frameworks, all of the legal, moral, traditional frameworks that help to define who you are, help to tell you who you are, they fall away. And what's left is just what's inside you. And that's when you find out what's accidental and what's intrinsic. So it's a way of asking questions about human nature. It's a way of looking at the interface between individual and society, personality and social role. And those are endlessly fascinating themes. But I think also, that's a sort of highfalutin way of putting it, but I think also there's a lot of pleasure to be had in apocalypses.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a world that is uncertain, that is complicated, that is demanding, that is sometimes overwhelming. If the world were to end tomorrow and you were to survive, you'd suddenly find your life simplified in a lot of ways. You'd never have to worry about paying the rent. You'd mm-hmm. never have to worry about your commute, about getting into debt, about anything really, except how to, you know, catch a rat and cook it.
Yeah.
Life comes down to a series of very, very simple choices. And there is a sense in which the apocalypse presents as a kind of a holiday from the insuperable conundrums of modern existence.
And then the final novel of his that I wanted to discuss was the reason why I, like, originally planned to do this episode. I'd finally managed to pick up a copy of his most recent book, Someone Like Me. Not Someone Like You. Never mind, I'll find someone like me.
I wanted to pick his brain about subverting the expectations that I had going into this book and how committed it is to its premise. In particular, I asked him how deliberately he chooses to subvert the expectations of his stories.
It's certainly a choice to kind of subvert expectations. I think there are two kinds of pleasure that you get from a story, and they're both important. They're both to do with setup and payoff. And one is to do with the setup and payoff where you promise something and then you deliver it. And then the other is you promise something and you deliver something different, and the pleasure lies in the surprise, in that kind of holy shit moment when you realize that you've been faked out. And ideally, you try to do both. You try to do stories that deliver on their initial premise, but that also present surprises and Easter eggs along the way. In Girl with All the Gifts and Boy on the Bridge, I think a lot of the surprising stuff has to do with presenting zombies from the inside, having sort of sympathetic zombie point of view characters. In Someone Like Me, what I was trying to do, it's a story about domestic violence, obviously. It's also a story about possession, but it leaves you guessing for a while as to what the mechanism is, and whether the mechanism is psychological, to do with mental illness, or whether it's to do with a supernatural origin or something completely different. And you know, part of the point of the story is to allow those uncertainties to sort of generate in your mind and linger there for a while before the payoff comes.
Mm-hmm. With Someone Like Me, I really thought that from the blurb and like from the first few chapters that the story of the main character, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head now, the one who has the split, Liz.
Yeah.
I really thought that her story was going to be about like accepting this other side of her, and like that the end message was going to be like, oh, the other side of me is me all along, and like I need to accept both sides of myself. And like, I'm really glad that you didn't do that, because like it did, like as you say, like it keeps you like on the edge of your seat more, because you are like, you don't know where it's going. So like, I do want to say that you did do a really good job with that.
I'm glad the fake out worked. That was definitely what I was aiming for. Yeah, that uncertainty would kind of feed into the climax.
Like in The Girl with All the Gifts as well. Like, if you go in and you don't know anything about it, then the first few chapters are about this girl in a school that seems really strange.
Yeah.
And like, it like takes a while for the ball to drop of like, I think she's a zombie actually.
Why is everybody treating us so cruelly?
Yeah.
It's nice to, it's fun to set up expectations and then to sort of like sneak around them in that way. We got to do it in the movie, I think even more effectively, because there's a lot of things that if you're seeing them, if they become visuals rather than just words on a page, they affect you differently. So it was Colin's idea to dress the kids in Guantanamo orange jumpsuits and to shave their heads. Mm-hmm. So that you're presented with these children who are, you know, institutionalized prisoners who are being treated like terrorists, like the worst of the worst. And I think the shock is all the more stark and extreme when you're looking at the film. Just as I think the scenes where they're walking into London through these city streets which have become mature forests, I think it's different to see there the some of the themes about our stewardship of nature and our place in the natural world come through more strongly if they're seen than if they're only described.
And that's it. That's Mike Carey.
Cool.
Before we sign off, I wanted to give Mike a chance to sign off for himself. And just to preempt him talking about a couple of, at the time, future dates, this is going to pull the curtain back a bit on when I recorded the interview. But you should still check out all the things that he talks about.
So I think I am all out of questions. Thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
What are you working on now? Where can people find you?
So I'm most of the way through a comic book miniseries, The Dollhouse Family, which will appear, the first issue's out in November. It's part of the Hill House Comics line at DC, a line of horror comics curated by Joe Hill. And I'm really sort of proud and happy to be a part of that. I'm having loads of fun. Peter Gross and Vince Locke, who were artists on the Unwritten, are the art team for the book. and I think it's some of the best work we've done. It's a story about a little girl who inherits a dollhouse, a magical dollhouse, and discovers that she can shrink down to doll size and go into it, but then discovers that there are strings attached to that deal. I've been working on that. I've been working on the Rampart trilogy, the Book of Coley, the Trials of Coley, and the Fall of Coley, all of which are coming out in 2020, 2021 from Orbit, which is me returning to post-apocalyptic themes. It's a coming-of-age story set about 300 years in the future in the Calder Valley in northern England. It's a young boy who decides to leave the village where he was born and go in search of the legendary lost city of London. And I'm also working on a movie screenplay with Colm McCarthy and Cammy Gatam, with the director and producer of Girl with All the Gifts, which is coming along really well. I'm going to touch wood as I say that. But we're in a really good place, and hopefully we will be going into production on that movie in 2020.
At the end of each episode, we each assign a number of flailings to the thing that we've been discussing. Sophie, how many flailings do you give Mike Carey as a human being? you can do his books, the ones that you've read.
I would group Girl with All the Gifts and Boy on the Bridge together.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably give them a solid, like, 5 or 6 out of 10 flailings.
Mm-hmm.
Because our number of flailings is, like, how obsessed are we?
Yep.
I probably will not be rereading these books because, as I said, they tap into two of my greatest fears in life.
Uh-huh.
So I think that they're objectively very good. It's just my enjoyment factor will always be dampened by my impending sense that I am going to get eaten by moldy zombies.
Mm-hmm.
But they are books that if someone was to say, oh, I've just read these books and I really want to talk about them, I would genuinely enjoy having in-depth chats with people about them. I just also am mildly scarred.
I think that I would... I mean, like, I feel like if a thing comes out and I see that his name is attached to it, then I will read it.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like if someone were to bring him up as well, because, like, it's not like an enthusiasm that is, like, an out-of-control, can't-stop-thinking-about-it-all-the-time enthusiasm.
Yeah, but you would 100% flail at someone about it.
Yes, I'd be like, oh my god, you've heard Mike Carey! Yes, let's talk about it, everything! What have you read? I mean, like, because I feel like that there is still so much more there that I can read.
Yes.
That it feels like there is still so much more room to grow in my enthusiasm.
Yes.
Yeah.
What numerical value is that on the flailing scale?
Oh, you're right. Very true. I think I would give him like an 8.5, I would say. Just because, like, yeah, like I will read anything that has got his name on it.
You are beginning the descent into obsession.
Yes. And as a nice, fun surprise, Sophie, my next topic is mold. We're going to flail about mold for an hour.
The thing is there's some really interesting things about mold in regards to food, but it still haunts me.
And that's the end of this episode of You Know What I Like. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, and please leave a rating and a review. It helps other people to find the show, and we'd love to be able to flail at more people.
We hope that you've enjoyed listening to us ramble, and please follow the podcast on Twitter at YKWILpodcast, or drop us an email at YKWILpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next month, where we get overly excited about history with an interactive quiz.
Forfeits. See you then.